This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
In American football history, there's a first time for everything, and it's really special when somebody digs in and finds a first time that maybe we hadn't heard of. Timothy P. Brown of footballarchaeology.com has found another first in football. It's significant, and I'm going to let Tim tell you all about it. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Aaron, look forward to chatting, and just want to say that Allison Danzig was a writer who struggled with his prose.
Oh, boy. Oh, gosh. We might have to take a station break here after that one. We might be banned. But Tim has written a tidbit recently on the author Allison Danzig and a great football historian. It's called Allison Danzig and the Crescent Athletic Club. So really, you got two great pieces of history here and just in the title, and we'd love to hear what this story is about.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, we talked about some of this last week where, you know, there were the way football has evolved. People in an earlier period could not have imagined that happening. They could not have foreseen the evolution. You know, last week you talked about penalties and how those evolved. But here the issue is, so Allison Danzig was, you know, a top sports writer, wrote for the Brooklyn Eagle and New York Times for like 45 years, you know, so, but he was probably best known for tennis, but he covered a lot of football too. And, you know, he wrote an article that caught my eye, just, you know, one of these I stumbled upon. It was like 1921. And he wrote an article arguing for somebody to revive the Crescent Athletic Club. So, and because he wanted college, you know, post-college players to be able to continue playing football, you know. In 1921, this is right after World War I, so there had been a lot of former college players who'd played, you know, military ball, you know, during the war. So, you know, maybe that had something to do with him raising this issue. But, you know, he was going back to the day, mid-1880s through the 1990s and, you know, maybe a little bit further, where the Crescent Athletic Club was, you know, maybe the top football team in the country. And, you know, they won their league, and it was like the American Football League or something like that. I can't remember the name of it. But then it kind of faded away, right? But it was the Crescent team was mostly made up of former Yale players who were, you know, working on Wall Street or whatever they were doing in the New York area. But they had a bunch of Princeton guys too. And then the Orange Athletic Club was their rival, and they were over in New Jersey. And then they play Harvard and Yale and other teams, Princeton sometimes, Penn sometimes. So they play a very competitive schedule. Typically they'd lose to the college teams. And at the time I think the guys just weren't in as good a shape as the college players was part of it. They didn't practice as much. And, you know, so, you know, that kind of led to this belief that, you know, football's a college game. You're never really going to have guys continuing to play for all that long because they get too old, right? They get 25 or something. And so anyway, so he writes this piece in 21 kind of saying, wouldn't it be great if somebody would recreate the, you know, the Crescent AC and some other team, you know, because they got to play somebody. But it would be so cool because these former college greats would have a chance to play. And so he wrote that piece, and it's just very clear that he could not have conceived of professional football developing.
But you said this is 1921, though. So this is the second year of the NFL.
Yeah. The
APFA is going on. And
it's a rinky-dink little soda pop.
There's a lot of professional teams, though. You know, a lot of localized teams, especially on the East Coast.
And let's look at where these teams are. Because, you know, they had teams in big markets. But among the teams in the NFL in 1921 were Akron, Canton, Dayton, Evansville, Green Bay, though they were suspended. And Green Bay was a rinky-dink little town then.
Mm-hmm.
Still kind of is. Hammond, Indiana, Tonawanda, and Muncie, Indiana. So, you know, these are not thriving metropolises, right? I mean, there was a lot of rinky-dink outfits, guys moving from team to team, and just, you know, they wouldn't practice during the week because they all had jobs, and they'd show up Saturday afternoon or something, maybe run around a little bit, you know. So anyways, you know, the point is that here's this a guy who's as well-informed as anybody in the football world. If he's writing about football for the New York Times, he's got a sense of the game, and he just can't conceive that this, you know, this AAPC or NFL or whatever it was called that year was ever going to amount to
APFA.
Yeah, whatever. You know, so, I mean, but to me, that's the interesting story, that he just cannot conceive of it. You know, because at that time you had these early NFL teams, you had other Pennsylvania, Ohio League teams, but like on the West Coast, the best football post-college was, you know, athletic club teams. You know, you had now I'm blanking on the name. The guys in Portland. You had the Olympic Club in San Francisco. You know, there were others, but you know, those were the best. And then a lot of military teams still, you know, they'd draw sellout crowds for the Armistice Day games and for the President's Cup games. And those are in big, you know, big time cities, you know, so 50, 60, you know, 1,000 people for some of those games. Anyways, I just think it's so, you know, it's like even into World War II, there were still people who discounted the professional game. And it's really not until the 60s where it really takes off and supersedes, you know, the college game. You know, I mean, as much as we talk about stars of the 50s, you know, in the NFL, it was, you know, I mean, go look at newspapers and see the coverage of NFL games in their home cities. And a lot of times they don't get tremendous coverage, you know, even like Chicago with the Bears. I mean, they go look through the papers of the 1950s and half the time that, you know, it's not like it leads the headlines for the, you know, for the sports page. So anyways, I just, you know, to us, the NFL is such an impressive, you know, enterprise, and it's just, it definitely is the leading, you know, source of football today. But
it definitely got catapulted by television, you know, the 1958 championship game, you know, going to overtime and being publicized, and the AFL and their contracts and the NFL competing. And, you know, that definitely stirred up the interest and generated money and revenue. And I think that's really what put it over the edge against the college in the 60s. But
the colleges were just too afraid to embrace television because it took away from paid attendance. And
they love it now. They love that TV revenue now.
Yeah. They've had a change of heart.
Right. And change of checkbook too, and their savings account. All right. Well, that is some great stuff. You know, that's something that I would never have imagined, that even somebody with the NFL, you know, I understand it wasn't too much on the East Coast, but still there was a lot of professional teams, but especially somebody reputable like Allison Danzig stating that. And you find these little, you know, trinkets of history that may have been long forgotten, and you bring them new life and bring them to our modern ears. And how can people take in some of this information that you put out there?
Yep. Just go to footballarchaeology.com. It's a Substack site. So you can subscribe, in which case you'll get an email every time I publish a story, or just bookmark it, come visit when you want, use the search function. And and also, you know, I've got books available on Amazon too. So if you want to do a deep dive on a couple of selected topics. So.
All right, Tim. Well, we appreciate it. And we would love to talk to you again next week about some more great football history.
Look forward to it.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.